Our last speaker of the day is Kathy Manley. She is the co-director of the legal committee for the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms. I'm sorry, I'm going to remember this one of these days. And also a member of Project Salon.
Thanks. I'll try without the microphone. Let me know if you can't hear me. So I started learning about this stuff, the entrapment cases and the preemptive prosecution, when I was part of the defense team for Yassin Arif in Albany, New York. He's over there, poster in the middle on the top next to Carlos Montes. He's an imam, Kurdish refugee from Iraq, had been persecuted by Saddam Hussein. The UN sent him to Albany, New York, where he became the imam of a small mosque. And for some reason, we don't even know, he was targeted by the FBI. Well, that whole mosque was targeted. And when we first started looking at the evidence, we didn't understand. There was no evidence. We didn't understand. It was based on he had witnessed a loan that he thought was a completely legitimate loan to a friend of his. And all he was doing was witnessing it, which is traditional for imams to do in the Muslim community, where they don't go to banks and they don't pay interest. So he had no idea there was anything illegal going on. And in a sting operation, the theory of it is that they're supposed to present the person with an opportunity to commit a crime and kind of maybe coax them into it, or somehow they agree to commit a crime. That wasn't the case with Yassin or his co-defendant, really. They thought it was just a loan. And this informant, provocateur named Shahed Hussein, was so tricky and so deceitful. The FBI even said he was chosen because he was good at being deceitful, but he even lied to the FBI, which they do. And so they knew they had a really weak sting case, because in sting cases, usually when there's recorded conversations, the defendant usually has said something that they show they're going along with this, even if they're entrapped into it. Yassin didn't even do that. He was convicted based on what the informant said, and they assumed that Yassin understood, which he didn't understand because he didn't even speak much English. And it was several months of conversations, a jumbled phrase here, a jumbled phrase here, a couple months later. It was crazy. But one of the things they did was they used secret evidence, which I had never seen before. So early on, the government said, we want to lock Yassin up before trial, probably keep him in solitary confinement, because he's a terrorist commander. We found his name in this notebook in Iraq where we bombed people, and we're saying they're terrorists now, and his name was there, and it said the word commander next to it. And we said, really? Give us that page so we can check out that translation. And when we got that page, the government wrote a letter saying, oh, sorry, there was a little mistranslation. It's not even an Arabic word. It doesn't mean commander. It's the Kurdish word for mister or brother, a respectful term, and the most common word in the Kurdish language.
Wow.
So then after that, he got out on bail for a while. And then they invoked the Classified Information Procedures Act. Then my boss, who was the lead trial attorney, I mainly do appeals, Terry Kinlan, he had to go through this intensive background check to get a security clearance to be able to look at this secret evidence, which was being presented to the judge already. And he finally got that security clearance and still didn't get to see any of that evidence. They said it wasn't material and helpful to the defense under their way of looking at it. So the judge got to see all this stuff. We don't know what it was. It was probably along the lines of the commander mistranslation. And we still don't know what it was. We've got a little bit of a clue recently that they thought he was somebody else who was an Al-Qaeda member, and now they know it's not him because that person got killed. But that's just recently. This is going way back to 2004. They're presenting all this secret evidence, and even the guy with the security clearance didn't get to see it. Jury didn't get to see it, but because of the secret evidence, the judge told the jury, oh, don't worry why they targeted him. The government had good reasons, good and valid reasons for targeting your client. Or, that should be reversible error in any normal case. But as Colleen was saying, there's no rule of law, not with these cases. And it spreads more and more. The more we don't stop it, the more it spreads, as we've been seeing lately. So one of the things I wanted to go back to what Mel said about the Holy Land Foundation case, because the preemptive prosecution, where it's like they target certain people and they go after them in any way they can. In Yassine's case, they did this crazy sting operation. In the Holy Land case, they charged them with material support for terrorism. And that's in 2010, the Supreme Court said that you can be convicted of material support for terrorism, even if what you're doing is completely peaceful, even if you're writing an op-ed, you know, saying that there should be negotiations between this group and that group, even if, you know, you're helping groups to work their differences out in a peaceful way. So what they did in the Holy Land Foundation was, as Mel said, help build schools and hospitals in Gaza. And what the government said was, well, no, none of this money is going to Hamas. None of this money is going to any violence. But what it's doing is it's enhancing the prestige of Hamas. And therefore, that's material support to terrorism, because Hamas is a designated terrorist organization, even though they won the election and they're controlling Gaza. It's insane. And that's what the people like Jess and the other people in the Twin Cities that were subpoenaed and that are facing the grand jury investigation, they're looking at trying to build a material support for terrorism case against them, too. So it's spreading. And as far as one of the main things I wanted to talk about was the provocateurs and informants, because the guy that was used in Yassine Aref's case, Shahed Hussein, he went by the name Malik in our case, and we thought, well, we probably won't be hearing from him again because he was just trying to keep from being deported back to Pakistan, where he faced a murder charge, and you know he had committed fraud at the motor vehicles department, and he was facing a whole bunch of felonies, and those went away. So that's probably why he did it, and he won't keep doing it. Well, lo and behold, we found out that he had moved down the Hudson River a little way to the small, economically depressed town of Newburgh, New York. And he was used there in another really crazy sting operation to set up four very down-and-out Muslim converts who none of them even had a driver's license. One was schizophrenic and homeless. They were still doing drugs. They were trying to sell drugs with Shahed Hussein. And he said he totally trapped them, especially James Cromedy, who was mainly the only one he dealt with. Shahed Hussein was sent into the mosque down there for a year by the FBI and was told to find some Muslims to target. They didn't even have anybody they were targeting. They just sent him into this mosque, a fishing expedition. And he couldn't find anybody there. As a matter of fact, the people there didn't like him. They didn't even want him in the mosque. So he was reduced to hanging around the parking lot, which is where he finally ran into James Cromedy, who didn't go to the mosque a lot either. And they started trying to con each other. Basically, Cromedy was trying to con him for money, which he said, oh, I got lots of money. I can set you up. I'll get you a Mercedes, like my three Mercedes. You know, I'll set up you up in a barber shop, all this stuff. And they started talking about this plot, and it was a pretty bad-sounding plot to bomb a synagogue and blow up airplanes. I don't even think any of them seriously wanted to have anything to do with it. They just were trying to get money out of this guy, Shahed Hussein, who was trying to con them for the FBI. And at one point, Cromedy didn't even want anything to do with Shahed Hussein, and he avoided him, wouldn't take his calls. And finally, Shahed Hussein gets Cromedy on the phone and says, listen, brother, I promised you $250,000. It's a guy that doesn't have $10 to his name. You don't want it? And so, of course, Cromedy says, oh, okay, I'm in, right? And yet, somehow, that wasn't entrapment. The jury, I mean, that is classic entrapment, the definition of entrapment. There is no entrapment defense if that isn't entrapment. And yet the jury was so afraid at the idea that these guys would have been willing to do this after this whole process that they convicted them and they got sentenced to 25 years. And so then, oh, and also we wanted to get a picture of this guy. Once we realized they were still using him, we wanted to get his picture out there. to try to warn people, because clearly they like using him. And we had a picture that we got from the Newberg case, but it wasn't that great of a picture, and the judge had said, oh, you can't use it, you have to blur it, like they told everybody in the courtroom. And so we were like, well, should we use it? Yeah, we're going to use it, we're going to give it to Democracy Now!, they're going to run it. But luckily, there was a New York Times photographer who saw him in a cafe across the street from the courthouse one day after trial, just sitting there. So he took this great picture of him, put it in the New York Times, and I was like, yes, that's even better. So his picture's out there, and it's, you know, if you Google Shahed Hussein on the internet, you'll see a bunch of pictures of it, of him. And then we thought, well, are they still going to use him now that his picture was in the New York Times? I don't know. So we didn't know. We hadn't heard anything. And then a few months ago, Project Salaam, we got an email from this guy named Khalif Al-Akili, who's a Muslim in Pittsburgh, New York. And he said, I wanted to let you know that there's been these guys that have been bothering me, and I think they're FBI. They've been talking about jihad and all this stuff, even though I don't want anything to do with them. They keep bugging me. And so one of them gave me his phone number. So I thought, huh, I'll Google the phone number. Well, sure enough, this is really stupid, right? The phone number, he's using the same phone number. It came up to the transcript from the Newberg case.
Wow.
And like the conversation with the $250,000, that's what it came up to.
Nice.
And so then he knew, oh, that's the guy. And he got his picture and saw, yes, this is the guy that just came to talk to him about jihad. So I said, huh, wow. Do you mind if we share your email more widely? Do you want us to? Oh, yes, please. I want everybody to know about this. And say, well, you know, you're blowing the whistle. They may come after you. He says, I don't care. They can't do anything to me. And so we sent it out very widely. And it got an article in the Albany, local Albany paper, and in the Washington Post, too. But right before NCPCF was going to have a press conference with Khalifa, what do you think happened? They arrested him, 5 a.m. in the morning. They come in, arrest him, spent all day with a whole team of FBI agents at his house, taking all his computers, combing through everything. And they charged him with a old gun charge, just like they are doing to Carlos Montes, because he had Khalifa had an old drug conviction from many years earlier, and he had gone to a public rifle range, was shooting, and I guess they found out about that from probably wiretaps, or, you know, just looking at all his emails and everything. And so they charged him with this felon in possession of a firearm charge federally, which they may not even be able to prove, because, you know, is that even possession when you're at a public firearm? It's not even, you know, firing range is not even your own gun. I don't know. But they're also trying to build some kind of case against him by what they're doing now is going to all of his Facebook friends and interviewing them. And I'm one of his Facebook friends there. They didn't interview me. I friended him on Facebook after this, since I wanted to see what was on his Facebook to see, you know, if he had any reason to be concerned. But one of his other Facebook friends who lives near me contacted us and said the FBI showed up at my door and wanted to talk to me because I'm his Facebook friend. I said, well, I can represent you, but I'm also his Facebook friend. He's like, well, maybe somebody else should represent me. And we're, you know, we're telling him, you have no reason to talk to the FBI just for being Khalifa's Facebook friend. But this is what they're doing. They're trying to go after Khalifa because he blew the whistle on them. And as people have said, this has spread, well, first of all, it's not just, I mean, it was going on a long time ago to the American Indian Movement with COINTELPRO and the Black Panthers and all sorts of other communities, leftists, and now it's spreading beyond Muslims. And as people have said, at first, you know, going after Jess and her friends with the material support for terrorism charges using an undercover FBI agent, and then more recently going after Occupy-related people, like in Cleveland, the informant there was Shaquille Azir, and he basically, these guys were talking about using a smoke bomb, and he kind of convinced them to try to blow up a bridge, supposedly, I don't know, but another, you know, example of entrapment. And then even much more recently with NATO and the Mo and Gloves, the provocateurs that were sent in to entrap them. And they're, you know, They're also charged with material support for terrorism under Illinois state law and conspiracy charges. So the whole way they use informants and provocateurs, it's very destructive. And it's, of course, destructive when you're targeted by an informant, but it also creates a whole destructive, paranoid culture where everybody becomes worried about, is this my friend or my enemy? Is this, you know, and there's ways you can kind of try and figure that out, but, you know, it causes so much paranoia. Like two guys from the mosque in Albany where Yassin was imam, they've been friends for 30 years, and they became suspicious of each other, that they were suspicious that the other was trying to set them up, and one of them ended up going to the FBI because he was afraid that the other one was trying to set him up. And then I had to deal with that, and actually did an interview with the FBI in that case because they gave him a grand jury subpoena. Anyway, it just, and that never had to happen. That was people being overly paranoid. Because that's the kind of corrosive effect that this has on communities. So you gotta keep your eyes open, be careful, but don't overreact. And as people have said, the most important thing is we need to learn from the past, from what's been done to other groups in the past, and we need to reach out to everybody else that it's being done to now. And one of the ways you can do that is by joining with us in NCPCF. We have the Committee to Stop FBI Repression is a member, the United Anti-War Committee is a member, about 10 different Muslim groups and non-Muslim groups, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and other groups. The website is civilfreedoms.org. It's a really great website, and you can learn more there. So, thank you.